You are listening to A Novel Podcast, in-depth discussions of literature from all genres and generations. I'm your host, Russell, and today I'm joining you without any co-hosts. This episode may be a little bit on the short side, but there are two books that I wanted to touch on, and I feel like they are definitely worth discussing. So today we're going to go ahead and discuss two books and their movie adaptations. First, The Road by Cormac McCarthy, and then The Prestige by Christopher Priest. Please note that during this episode, I will be spoiling the story for both the novels and the respective films, so if you haven't seen or read any of them, and you don't want to have them ruined, you may want to pause and then come back. We're going to go ahead and start with The Prestige, so if you want to skip ahead to just listen to the part where we talk about The Road, you can go ahead and skip to
21 minutes and 30 seconds.
I'd also like to point out that both of the novels we're going to be discussing today are available through Audible's library on audible.com. Now, if you're not familiar with audible.com, it's a subscription service where you're going to be getting audiobooks on a regular basis. And those books that you receive are yours to keep for life. It's not a subscription service where as soon as you no longer subscribe, everything that you've gotten is now gone. You get to keep everything that you get. It's just on a recurring basis. It's a really awesome way to get your audiobooks. It's super convenient. And if you've never tried audiobooks before, I would strongly recommend it. If you like podcasts, which I'm assuming you do because you're listening to this one, I think you'll also like audiobooks. So if you want to go to audibletrial.com/anovelpodcast, you're going to be able to get a free trial and a free download of any audiobook, including the two that we're going to be discussing today, but not limited to that. You can get any book from their entire library. So strongly recommend giving that a try. audibletrial.com/anovelpodcast. Let's go ahead and get into it now. Before we actually start talking about the movies and the books, I'm going to take just a minute here to discuss a few of the different ways that I feel like you can judge a movie adaptation of a book, or a book adaptation of a movie for that matter. I'm going to go ahead and use The Lord of the Rings and Harry Potter as common examples. The first one is omission versus alteration. So obviously, if you're making a two-hour-long movie, it's not necessarily going to be able to fit every single piece of an 800-page novel into it. In fact, I think a lot of the popularity of television shows now is you can take something like George R.R. Martin's A Song of Ice and Fire, which at this point has got to be, quick math in my head, 4,000 pages, I don't know, just a guess, and able to suss it out over a long period of time. And rather than sitting through a 3.5-hour movie like the extended versions of Lord of the Rings, you've got a lot more time to build out that world. So one of the common tricks that we'll use, the filmmakers will use, is an omission. So frankly, there's nothing really wrong with that. I look at Tom Bombadil and I think, well, you know, it would have been cool to see him in the Lord of the Rings movies, but that would have been a good 20, 30 minutes of movie that doesn't have a huge impact on the entire story. It's world building, it's important, but it's not so important that you absolutely need to include that in your film. But then there's alterations, and I can't quite fathom some of the alterations that are made in film adaptations. Sometimes you've got to make a slight alteration in order to explain an omission. I don't have a good example of this, but you know what I'm saying. Like, normally they would have gone through the caves, so let's change someone's answer so that way they don't have to go through the caves, they can just take a ferry, and the ferry is 2 minutes of film, whereas the caves might have been an hour. Okay, that makes sense. But what about Entmoot from The Two Towers? I cannot fathom the discussion, the reason that the filmmakers chose to totally switch around the way they did Entmoot. So if you remember in the novel, Entmoot, the Ents decided that they would attack Isengard. Okay, that was their choice. Now, the entire time, you're learning these guys are slow, not hasty at all. So in the movie, they decide, no, we're not going to attack. But then when they see what happened, they immediately turn around and change their minds. And to me, this is totally backwards. So I can't fathom why they would have altered that whatsoever. It doesn't seem to help at all. So if you can look at changes that a filmmaker would make to a novel adaptation, you can see, well, maybe there's good reasons why this was changed. Maybe this is an omission that actually helps make the film work a little bit faster. Pacing reasons seems to be the common war cry of the filmmaker on a novel adaptation. The other thing that you can have is additions and omissions. And this is a little on the strange side, and I'll refer to Harry Potter on this one. No specific examples, but if you look at the Harry Potter novels, there is a lot of good humor in the novels. I mean, there's plenty of times where you're laughing at the antics of the characters, or somebody makes a joke, or, you know, whatever. If you look at the movies, however, particularly the third, fourth, fifth movies, I find that there's a lot added and omitted, and you didn't need to do both. You could have kept it original. And humor is a big one. The jokes that were added to these movies were not particularly good when you compare them to the jokes in the novels. And it's not like the jokes in the novels wouldn't work on film. They would work just fine. A lot of the times it's just something somebody says. But for whatever reason, the filmmakers decided that they were going to add their own spin to it, that the producers maybe were going to try and make it more broadly appealing. I'm grasping at straws here. I have no reason why they would have done this. So you can look at additions and omissions as well. When paired together, that can be a recipe for disaster. One thing, though, you really need to look at if you're going to be considering, or judging, I should say, an adaptation of a novel on film, is what is the overall theme? Did they get that right? Does it feel right? Does it feel like the novel? It feels like the novel has come to life. And I think a lot of novel adaptations really, they do manage to get the feel right, which is why a lot of times you can point to certain scenes and say, yes, this is exactly how I pictured it. Overall, though, I had to deal with all these omissions and additions and omissions and alterations, and I couldn't stand it. But I did really enjoy this one scene, or this one character was a really good actor. So that leads me into what could be another way to look at this is what about just the characters? When you picture Gandalf, you know, who do you see? Or who did you see before you watched the movies? And that can be tough when you are in love with a novel and you picture a character in a certain way in your head. And then all of a sudden it's a movie and now you're seeing this movie. And from now on, it's always going to be Ian McKellen. And you can't even go back and think, oh my goodness, who did that look like? So you got to think about that as well. And then finally, we talked about this a second ago, was specific scenes. Is there a specific scene that you feel was done very, very, very well or very, very, very poorly? And sometimes you can say, well, the movie wasn't very good, but at the very least, I really enjoyed this one scene. For me, the two scenes in Lord of the Rings, my favorite and my least favorite, are if the scene where the Fellowship of the Ring, where the hobbits are on the road, they've got the ring, they're just about leaving the Shire, and they see the Ringwraith coming. In the novel, it's one of my favorite scenes in the novel, and in the movie, it's way over-stylized and not scary and not realistic at all. Not what I was imagining. I was imagining something a lot more subtle, I suppose. And so that scene was super-duper disappointing for me. However, and I'm going to go spoiler-free here, the scene that I absolutely adore from the movie is from The Return of the King. And that's the scene where you have the last men standing at the gates of Mordor. And at the same time, you've got Sam and Frodo with Gollum hanging out on the mountain. And of course, some things happen shortly thereafter. And those things that happened are exactly how I imagined they would. When I envision that scene in my head upon reading the novel, the movie adaptation of it was exactly what I saw in my head, almost perfectly, in a very scary way, perfectly. So you've got omissions and alterations where they're changing things or taking things out. Possibly they're adding in things that they could have taken straight from the novels. You've got characters portrayed by actors who are either doing a really good job or a really bad job. And sometimes even if they're doing a really good job, it's still not the way you saw it. And then sometimes they've got specific scenes that are either really, really near and dear to your heart that they ruin, or maybe they just nailed it. They got it just exactly right. So a lot of different ways that you can judge film adaptations of novels, or possibly vice versa. So with that being said, I want to go ahead and start talking about The Prestige by Christopher Priest. It's a British novel. It was written in 1995. And I'd really like to start talking in this particular case about the movie, which wasn't released until 11 years later, 2006. I saw the movie on Netflix, the disc service, years ago, probably like in 2008. And I really, really like that movie a lot. It stars Christian Bale and Hugh Jackman. And it's the movie that made me fall in love with Michael Caine. And if you haven't seen Dirty Rotten Scoundrels, you really need to. Michael Caine is awesome, and that movie is hilarious. Of course, Christian Bale, it was directed by Christopher Nolan, and it stars Christian Bale, so got that whole Dark Knight feeling going on. Christopher Nolan, of course, also directed Inception, so he's a really good director to follow. And the interesting thing was that exact same year, there were several other magician movies that were released at the same time. The Illusionist, starring Paul Giamatti and Edward Norton, and Scoop. This is a romantic comedy that I'd never heard of before, but interesting, Scoop also stars Hugh Jackman and Scarlett Johansson. And then this movie that just came out, The Greatest Showman, also starring Hugh Jackman, looks extraordinarily similar to The Prestige, just on the surface, just visually. I found that very interesting. But I love the movie so much that it kind of stuck in my brain as one of my favorite movies of the decade. And interestingly, walking through the library one day, I happened to notice there it was, audiobook, but it was just sitting right there. So I thought, oh, I've got to try this. And the how do I describe it? The difference between the two is very intriguing. And this one strikes me, this pair strikes me as one of the very, very few times, and without a doubt the most popular time, that the movie is demonstrably better than the book. It's not a bad book. It's a very good book. But I will say that without a doubt, the movie is just better in general. And one other way that you can judge, and I probably should have brought this up earlier, but one other way that you can judge a movie versus a book is one of them actually better than the other? Or is one better in its own category than the other is in its? And what I mean by that is the movie a better movie than the book is a book? Are you judging them both in terms of their quality of art, or even pop art? Or are you judging them both in terms of their quality of their particular media? In this case, this is one of the few times that I will say, well, not only is the movie a better movie than the book is a book, but also the movie just in general is better than the book. And that strikes me. And it's almost kind of cheating, because my rule of thumb is whatever's popular first is always going to be better, because you're trying to copy something. You're trying to cash in on a popularity. And in this case, there really wasn't one. This was just somebody who said, oh, that's a neat story. Let me go ahead and turn something into this. And Christopher Nolan just took it, ran with it, polished up a few edges, and really did a great job. All right, so let's dive into this a little bit. The story, this is about two magicians who had been partners, and something happens to tear them apart, and now they're trying to outdo each other. This is in 1800s England. Now, the novel is told in an epistolary style, with each chapter being a different document or a letter or journal entry, kind of similar to Dracula and a bunch of other popular works of fiction. Now, as the rivalry begins to heat up, we can see both of these characters going to more and more extreme lengths to try and outdo each other. And that's really kind of the crux of the novel. It's going back and forth between the two. And really, it's about the parallels of rivalry between the two. Now, obviously, this is something that had happened in real life. So it's kind of a period piece in that particular way. Reading the Wikipedia page gave me a very interesting idea, though, and that's not only was it about illusionists who were trying to outdo each other, but in addition to that, you could parallel this with the Tesla and Edison rivalry, which makes absolutely perfect sense because Nikola Tesla is a big part of the plot. And these themes of parallels themes of the rivalry parallel a theme of obsession. You know, both characters are getting extremely invested in trying to outdo each other and resorting to violence and rather other extreme measures. And it reminded me a lot, thinking about it from that angle, it reminded me a lot of the movie Black Swan, which if you haven't seen Black Swan, I would strongly recommend that as well. If you're into the theme of obsession over your craft, Black Swan's a terrific story in that particular regard. So The story between these two kind of comes to a head when one of them comes up with a trick they call the transported man, where you have two cabinets on stage. On the opposite ends of the stage, one man jumps into one cabinet, and then he jumps out of the other cabinet, almost immediately. Well, how did he get from one to the other? So we'll follow the great Danton, who's seeing this trick that his rival is doing. And he's going to go ahead and contract Nikola Tesla to recreate this trick using a teleportation device. So the story, and this is where we're going to get into spoilers here, but the story is that Tesla creates this device, but it's not actually a transportation device. What he has created is a duplication device. So anything you put inside this device is going to be duplicated like 30 yards down to the left of the machine. So the great Danton is using this duplicator to appear to disappear. It is appearing like he's disappearing and reappearing on the other side of the theater almost immediately. But he's actually duplicating himself, and the original that was inside the duplicator on stage is being disposed of. So the difference between the novel and this is where the difference between the novel and the book become very, very important. Now, his rival, Alfred Borden, the man who created the transported man, finds out and tries to expose him. And through the plot, we learn that Borden is actually two men, that he was identical twins. And the two of them, since they started this illusionist career, have taken turns being the front man and then their assistant. So they'd be disguised as this guy who wears a lot of fake beards and things. And some of the extreme lengths we find out they go to is, at one point, Alfred Borden is shot and loses his finger. And so his twin brother has to cut his finger off in order to continue to be Alfred Borden. And this goes back to the theme which you see in the movie displayed so well. They're both watching this Chinese illusionist pull on this trick. He's hobbling around like an old man the whole time. And he does this trick where he creates this huge fish bowl filled with water and fish out of nowhere. So that sets the stage very early on for this theme of obsession and dedication. And the idea is this old Chinese illusionist was able to create this effect by holding on to the fishbowl between his legs. So he's not old, he's not enfeebled, he's actually really strong. And the entire time he's out on stage, he is carrying this fishbowl around with him. And that feeble hobbling around is just an act to make you think that he has to walk that way, when the reason he has to walk that way is because he's got that fishbowl in between his legs. So the great lengths that he goes to in order to make this trick work are paralleled in Alfred Borden going to great lengths to only live half a life, and Robert Angier, the great Danton, going to such great lengths as to dispose of the prestige materials. And again, the prestige materials is where both the novel and the movie do a really good job of creating this tension and this theme and expounding on it and really bringing it to surface in a way that is very entertaining. However, when it comes to the prestige materials, it seems like Christopher Nolan or whoever wrote the screenplay had a much better idea than the original author, Christopher Priest, had. Because the prestige materials, what's created by that duplicator in the novel, is this kind of like ghosty corpse. It's not exactly a corpse, a copy of the great Danton. It's this ghost-like image that he needs to kind of pile up in this warehouse. It has no life. What he finds out over time is that he's becoming less real every time he uses the duplicator. Okay. Interesting story. In the end, he tries to kill himself, but he can't do it. He's become too ethereal. He's paying for what he sacrificed. He has to pay the piper now. However, in the movie, and this is why I think the movie is better, is because the movie simplifies this quite a bit. It actually makes a duplicate. It makes a second person. And that second person is dropped from the stage into a vat of water, filled all the way to the brim, and drowns. And so the great Danton has got blind people working as his crewmen. No one's allowed to be downstage, downstairs under the stage, because he doesn't want any of them to see that during this trick, you're going to hear a splash and a clank, and I might struggle a little bit, but then you'll hear applause. Okay, so that's what they're going to hear. If they weren't blind, they would see that now there is a corpse inside this huge tank of water. And he even goes so far as to say, well, I'm only going to be doing 30 of these. And then in a little self-narrative, he says, you have no idea how hard it was to not know who I would turn out to be. Would I be the man on the other side of the theater? Or would I be the man inside the box filled with water? Without reading it and seeing it yourself, which I'm assuming you've at least read one, seen one of these two pieces of art and experienced it for yourself if you're listening to this right now, it's difficult to describe exactly why it kind of falls flat in the book and just soars in the movie. But I wanted to highlight this because, you know, I'd love more opinions on this. Is this really one of those rare cases where the movie is better than the book? Or is this just my personal preference? Or was there an artistry to the book that I missed? Or is the novel just popular rubbish? I'm not sure. So with that, let's go ahead and move on to The Road. Now, The Road was written in 2006, and that was the same year that the movie, The Prestige, came out. This is telling the story of a father and son who are making their way through a post-apocalyptic landscape. Some interesting choices that Cormac McCarthy uses here is there are no names to any of the characters. The story is exceptionally grim. The entire theme of the novel seems to be one of hopelessness. The father is desperately trying to get the son out to the coast. General idea is we're trying to get away from where we had been living and trying to find something better for us. I have no idea if there actually is going to be something there or not. But they're moving that way on kind of just a hope and a prayer. It is an extraordinarily difficult book to read. The first time I read it, I didn't have any children. And even then, it was not an easy book to go through. I didn't know what I was getting into. And even at the time, it was still extraordinarily difficult to read. Now, I have gone to try and reread it again several times, trying to go back. And now, after I have kids, it's almost impossible. I haven't been able to make my way through the book since then. But now what actually happens in the story, you know, ultimately, we're never told exactly what happened. The world is just extraordinarily bleak. Everything smells of ash. The food is tainted. The water is impure. And nothing is growing. Any sign of animal life is remarkable. And most of the time, you're just trying to stay hidden. Because if you encounter anybody, they're coming for you to take what you have. The only thing we really know about what actually happened to create this world is we can read on page 54, quote, a long shear of light and then a series of low percussions. So, and I'd like to thank the Poplar Tree blog for making this easy for me to find as well. So speculation, of course, being war, bombs, technological accident, comet, asteroid. One of the interesting theories that I read was about a supervolcano, and this phenomenon was first introduced to me through How Stuff Works podcasts. But the point is not what has happened to this world. The point is not what's going on in this world. The point is about this father taking care of his son through tough times. It is tight and thrilling. It's not overly saturated or overstimulated. It is an extremely good balance of action and tension and introspection. And if you're used to really high action novels, this one would probably seem rather boring. But the significance of what's happening probably won't be lost on you, because it is very, very just difficult. And imagining what they're going through is enough to keep you going page after page. I'd like to quote another blog here, the Pajiba blog, because they describe this extremely well. Quote, "In this world, action isn't exciting, it is terrifying. Because fighting or running means someone is trying to take what you have and or murder you. And a sprained ankle or a deep wound is probably a death sentence." So it's this theme of just surviving. And it's the kind of theme that if you look at zombie literature or zombie movies, part of it, especially in the beginning, is about scrounging for food, and you find something and everyone's really happy because, oh, look at this, we found these cans, they're still good. Yay, it's really good there. But a lot of times zombie novels and movies turn into a fight between humanity, you know, early on, and it turns into something else. This one really makes fighting for survival the main focus, giving it this theme of paternal duty that kind of spirals throughout the entire novel, leading you towards the end. Now, I have never really seen, I love this theme of paternal duty, but I've never really seen a theme quite as heavy as this outside of the movie The Pursuit of Happiness. I can't even think of something else that puts the main focus on paternal duty as much as this does. And not just paternal duty, but paternal duty in extreme circumstances. So let's talk about the movie here a little bit. And the reason I wanted to talk about this movie is because, unlike The Prestige, I feel like this was an extremely true adaptation of the film, or of the novel. And unlike The Prestige, I don't feel like they could have done something to make it better. But unlike most film adaptations, there were a few omissions, but I didn't pick up on any kind of alterations. Many of the scenes were exactly as I imagined them. The characters were extraordinarily well acted. So for all these reasons, and the fact that from the very beginning up until the very last scene, it seems, I hesitate to say perfect, because I'm sure there are things out there that you've noticed that are probably driving you nuts that don't bother me at all, or maybe I didn't even notice. But for lack of a better word, it seems like the perfect film adaptation of a novel. And it certainly is my favorite of all time, thus far. So the movie stars Robert Duvall, Guy Pearce, Charlize Theron, but they're only in it for a few moments. There was a fourth character. His name escapes me. I'm sorry. The name of the actor escapes me. But again, like in the novel, these characters don't actually get real names. It's the man, the boy, the father, the boy, the old man, the white, you know what I mean? The real stars of the movie are the father, Viggo Mortensen, and the son, Cody Smith McPhee. So the few minor differences here is that there's a little bit less introspection, a little bit less self-thought inside the novel, or inside the movie, just because the film doesn't lend itself to that nearly as well as novels do. But you do see that a bit from time to time, and the one scene in particular is when the father, constantly thinking about the wife and how she just gave up and how much it pains him to have to go through this alone. But at one point he takes his wedding ring off and leaves it just kind of up on a bridge. They're just walking across a bridge like a highway, and he just leaves it on the side of the bridge. And he leaves it in a way that almost makes me think like he's angry and he's going to pick it up and he's going to throw it. But he decides not to. It's very, very subtle. And he just sits it there and walks away. So there's a lot of little pieces like that, little introspective pieces that kind of make you understand what these characters are thinking. And the one difference that I picked up on was that there, at the end of both the novel and the book, there is this element of hope. Despite how bleak and abysmal everything is, we worked hard, and something good is going to come from this. You know, the boy is mentioning several times, we're the good guys, or these are the good guys. No, these are not. These are the cannibals. And in the end, you meet who may be the good guy. And in a little bit of an artistic scene, in the movie it's one thing, in the book it's another, there's an element of hope. Now, the two scenes are completely different, and this is where you got the spirit of it right, but what you actually showed was totally different. It's the only negative I can draw is that in the end, it felt different. Just the way that you did it just felt different. But in any event, I think they got the spirit of it right. So I would strongly recommend both of those. The novel is terrific. The movie is also terrific. So that's all I wanted to discuss today. I'll mention that, of course, next month we will be doing our episode on Ready Player One. We are currently reading Little Women. And we are actively looking for more ideas about what we should be reading next. A few suggestions came across our plate, as Shogun was one of them. Can't remember the name of that author. But anything that you would like to hear us discuss, we'd love your suggestions. Follow us on Twitter at A Novel Podcast or on Facebook, A Novel Podcast. And we look forward to seeing you next month.
A Novel Podcast is looking to produce more episodes, and we want you to join us. If you like reading novels and then talking about them, then you're a perfect candidate. We record remotely, so your location on Earth isn't a consideration, and no prior experience is necessary. Send us an email or a tweet and let us know what books you'd like to discuss. A Novel Podcast at gmail.com or at A Novel Podcast. Look forward to hearing from you.